The 2024 presidential campaign features two candidates who are very well known to Americans. And yet, there's complexity at every turn. Criminal trials for one of those candidates. Young voters who are angry. The Campaign Moment podcast from The Washington Post gives you what matters. I'm Aaron Blake, and I'm covering my 10th election cycle. My colleagues and I have insights that you won't find anywhere else. So follow The Campaign Moment right now, wherever you're listening.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Strange Arrivals is a production of iHeartRadio and Grim and Mild from Aaron Mankey. For the best experience, listen with headphones.
This is the second of two interviews I did while researching Heaven's Gate for season 3 of Strange Arrivals. In the end, I did not include Heaven's Gate in the main episodes of season 3 for a variety of reasons, but wanted people to be able to hear these interviews. The first one dropped last week. You can listen to them in either order. This is an interview with Ben Zeller, who is a professor of religious studies at Lake Forest College in Illinois.
My name is Ben Zeller. I'm a professor of religious studies at Lake Forest College outside of Chicago, Illinois.
Could you talk about Applewhite and Nettles' backgrounds, both, you know, religiously and otherwise?
Marshall Herf Applewhite, who is the leader of Heaven's Gate at the end, but only one of the two co-founders at the beginning, came from a pretty conventional Christian background. His father was a Presbyterian minister, and Applewhite was raised basically in the church. So for him, Christianity was just sort of the assumed background. He went to college. He actually considered becoming a minister himself, and he started at seminary. So he actually has some training as a Christian minister. He left seminary because he felt drawn into music as a career. It's sometimes hypothesized he also left because he realized that he was bisexual. We don't have any hard evidence of that, but it's certainly plausible that a closeted bisexual would have not felt comfortable in a Presbyterian seminary at the time. Either way, he leaves seminary, but he sticks with it long enough to really pick up the details of Christian theology. Even at the very, very end of Heaven's Gate, he talks about questions about predestination and election, which are Christian theological terms which make sense within the particular denomination he was trained in. So you can see he sort of never left it behind. He brings that Christianity with him.
Interesting.
Bonnie Lou Nettles, by contrast, was raised a Baptist, but was not particularly drawn into the tradition. A childhood friend said in an interview much later that she only went because the family went. So she was sort of your typical once a week at most, maybe once a month attendant, in keeping with sort of broader society. She was in Texas, so she was Southern Baptist, and nothing surprising there. As an adult, she became deeply interested in alternative spiritualities. She briefly joined the Theosophical Society. She was interested in spiritualism, interested in channeling, and she was far more religiously eclectic than Herf, than Applewhite was.
How did they run into each other? How did they meet?
There are different stories for how how Applewhite and Bonnie Lou Nettles met. The only commonality that we know for certain, based on what they said, what their friends said, what their family said, is they met in a hospital. The reasons that that Nettles was in the hospital, that's pretty clear. She was working there. Why Applewhite was in the hospital, there's a couple of different answers. He says he was visiting a friend. One of his family members said that he was suffering heart palpitations and was in there for treatment. And much later on, after the Heaven's Gate suicide, there's the claim that he was a mental patient. We can dismiss that last one because Nettles was not a psychiatric nurse. So there's no chance they would have met in a psych hospital. She wasn't working in one. She was working, I think, in OBGYN rotation at the time. So not likely that he was going in for that. I've always assumed, because we have sort of the two different stories, that yes, he was in for heart palpitations, but then he went to visit a friend afterwards. That's always sort of assumed that they're both correct. It makes sense. Either way, he ends up running into to Nettles in the hospital. And at this point in his life, Marshall Herff Applewhite feels like he's at a moment of transition. He's been experiencing these sort of spiritual encounters. He has these, he sort of hears these voices and feels this religious spiritual calling. He thinks like he has some sort of fate is calling him to do something. He doesn't know what, though, but he feels like he's at this sudden moment of transition. We should note he's been recently divorced. He's been fired from his job. He's sort of at this sudden moment of transition in his life. Nettles is also in a transition. She is also separated or in the process of separating. And when they meet, the story goes, and we have only their story to go with, that she said to him, well, let me do your chart. She's an astrologer. So she does his chart, and she says, actually, yeah, you do have a fate. You actually do have a destiny, but it's tied up with mine. The two of us together are bound for a journey. And off they go. And that's the story of the origin of Heaven's Gate.
Interesting. What is sort of the origin of the interest in UFOs?
Both Nettles and Applewhite were interested in UFOs even before they met. Nettles' interest in UFOs was bound up with her sort of neo-theosophical interest in channeling. Traditional theosophy involves sort of a receiving information from the beyond, usually from humans or from spiritually advanced beings, generally human, that sort of send messages. Neo-theosophy, sort of 20th century theosophy, these ascended masters, they come to be called, are often considered space aliens or angelic beings or supernatural beings. Today, we would call it New Age. At the time, it was sort of predates New Age. But within her alternative spiritual milieu, it made sense as a channeler that she would receive wisdom from the from extraterrestrials as well. We know that she received a contact or claimed to receive contact from deceased humans, so from the spiritual realm. So it would have made sense she had looked to extraterrestrials as well. But she was also interested in just sort of UFOs as a phenomena. So not just sort of the beings to communicate with her spiritually, but also the claims about sightings and crashes and things like that. Applewhite was a little more conventionally Christian in that way. He was open to Nettles' interpretation, but he came into it really trying to make sense of the Bible. And he used UFOs and space aliens to make sense of the Bible. But it was really Nettles, Bonnie Lou Nettles, who brought UFOs and ufology to him.
This is something I was looking at with other people, is that there are people who kind of look at UFOs as being the sort of the spiritual, almost like, you know, paranormal type thing. And then there's others who are, you know, look at that thing in the sky, it landed, it left marks. And then, you know, the people who try and sort of synthesize it, or at least are willing to accept like both aspects of it as being real, I think is kind of an interesting step that they have to take.
Both Nettles and Applewhite really did try to harmonize sort of that spiritual approach to UFOs and ufology, and also then the more sort of scientific approach. They certainly didn't come out of that. So basically the same time they were starting their work is when like MUFON, like the Mutual UFO Network was starting, although it was the Midwestern UFO Network at first. So there were sort of secular scientific UFO watchers and those who saw themselves as studying the evidence on the ground, literally on the ground, right? The imprints and such. They did not come from that world, but they were interested in engaging that. And they were interested in speaking to those who had a secular approach to UFOs because they really did believe that ultimately the UFOs were real. And that the beings who the Bible referred to as angels and gods and things like that are just biological extraterrestrial entities. And that all the miracles of the Bibles are simply UFO technology misunderstood. So they did ultimately agree that science and technology and sort of a secular approach was the way to understand UFOs and ufology and sightings and such. It's just that they were coming out of a religious milieu, and that's what they really created, is a religion. They really tried to have it both ways, if that makes sense.
What sort of novel ways did they use to integrate sort of the reality of UFOs in their view into sort of the theological and, you know, spiritual concerns they had coming into their partnership?
There's a couple of angles to what they tried to do. One is the sort of the von Däniken Chariots of the Gods style approach, where they simply, you know, looked at ancient material, in this case the Bible, as evidence of ancient aliens and astronauts who had visited the Earth, and this was recorded by primitive humans or comparatively primitive humans as religious, as opposed to it actually being, you know, space aliens. So that they were part of the vanguard of that. And this is the 1970s. So they were ahead of the curve in terms of that approach. I mean, now, of course, that's pretty, you know, pretty standard sort of within one aspect of ufology. What they also did, though, which was really different from that, is they tried to interpret the Bible and particularly the prophetic passages of Revelation with reference to this. So not just was it aliens visited the Earth in the past, but they're going to come back. And the book of Revelation describes how they're going to come back and how the end of our society as we know it is going to occur, and how those who have hopes of leaving our planet are going to be able to do that. And in particular, they took the idea of the rapture, which is a Christian and evangelical Christian idea about how the saved, the elect, will be lifted up off the planet and will go into heaven. Within the traditional Christian idea, it's Jesus meets them sort of halfway up and sort of lifts them up into heaven, and everyone else is sort of left behind. And in fact, Left Behind, there's a series of books called Left Behind, which were a fictional version of this, right? For them, though, it's a UFO, and Jesus is a space alien, and it's a tractor beam. And it's not heaven, it's the literal heavens, it's outer space. So that's their interpretation. And they fused this with what today we would call a new age focus on self-transformation and healing and self-development. So the initial idea was that you would go in bodily form onto the UFO and you would perfect your bodily being and your consciousness, and you'd sort of elevate yourself to a new level of being and sort of raise your vibratory frequency. It was very sort of new age language. They're really pulling from Christian biblical prophecy, new age healing and self-transformation, and the very sort of early ufology, and sort of combining it all in a really fascinating way.
I guess there's two questions. One is, like, who were the people who responded to this message, and what about the message was compelling to them?
Most of the converts, most of the people who either attended the meeting, so they had these massive public meetings all up and down the West Coast, from Los Angeles up through the Bay Area, up through Oregon and Washington. Most of the people who attended the meetings and most of those who actually joined were what I would call spiritual seekers. Those who stayed and those who left generally had tried other spiritual pursuits, and that ranged from actual other new religious movements like Scientology or transcendental meditation to sort of quasi-religious forms of living like communes. There was one member who had gone to Israel to join a kibbutz. There was a lot of interest in psychedelia and so, you know, in drug use and drug trips. So they'd all tried different things to sort of, you know, break out of the norm. Not all, I should say. There were a few who bucked the trend, but by and large, the vast majority were spiritual seekers. Of those who attended their meetings, and they had these large meetings with 50, 60, 100 people, 200 people at some of them, they usually wouldn't get any more than a few, you know, a dozen at most to join. So this didn't appeal to everyone. But for those who did feel attracted to it, what was generally new was the UFO angle from the way in which it connected to the biblical prophecy, because most of the folks who joined were probably already aware of sort of this, you know, the new age self-transformation elements of it. There were some individuals who joined for one reason or another who don't fit that pattern. So there were some people who were very, very Christian in orientation. And what really grabbed them was that this was a new way to interpret the Christian Bible, and it made sense to them. There were also at least a few examples of people who came in really through the UFO angle. What they were interested in was making sense of UFO sightings and landings, and the religious spiritual stuff was sort of secondary. But most of the members were grabbed by sort of initially that spiritual seeking. But what kept them in, because most people who joined left, their attrition rate was huge. The people who stuck around found that combination somehow appealing. It was never a large number of people. There were never more than 50, 60, 70 people at most, even early on. And of course, it ends with approximately 40. But even at its peak, it was no more than twice that size. So this was never a mass appeal. But for some people, that combination, New Age self-transformation, biblical prophecy, and making sense out of UFO sightings and sort of broader ufology, for some people, that was very appealing.
Was this sort of set of beliefs, was it fairly static over time, or were there changes as the members came and went, and they sort of, you know, Applewhite and Nettles sort of thought things over or had revelations or whatever?
the central beliefs both were consistent and radically changing the entire time. So this is really what's quite fascinating about them. On the one hand, it's totally consistent. From beginning to end, the point of the group that we come to call Heaven's Gate, and it had other names too, it was human individual metamorphosis, all sorts of other things. From beginning to end, their goal was to get off the planet. It was to leave Earth and ascend to a higher level of being, a higher level of existence, what they come to call the next level or the evolutionary level above human, on a UFO. So from beginning to end, that's consistent. The details changed over time, and the huge, massive change was whether they would go in bodily form. Initially, they told their followers at these sort of, not even their followers, at these mass meetings, they said publicly, you don't have to die. What we're offering is a trip to get onto the UFO and to go to heaven in your bodily form. There's no death required. You're going to transform your body like a caterpillar into a butterfly. Caterpillars don't die to become butterflies. They transform. And that was the metaphor they used. The other metaphor they used was graduation. Students don't die to graduate. They graduate. And it's, you know, in their bodies. So these were their metaphors. So you will graduate like a student, or you will transform like a caterpillar and go into the next level. And you will then be a perfected extraterrestrial being. You're going to live forever, never get sick, never need to eat. You're not going to suffer sort of the frailties of the flesh. And you get to take care of the universe. You're going to sail around in UFOs and manage the universe and manage planets. By the end, that transition was no longer bodily. It was your soul will go on and do that. You're going to get a new body, and you're going to leave the frail, broken human body behind. And that is a radical transition. There were other changes over time, too. Their particular biblical interpretations changed, things like that. But that's the big one. Everything else follows from there.
My conversation with Ben Zeller will continue after the break.
The 2024 presidential campaign features two candidates who are very well known to Americans. And yet, there's complexity at every turn. Criminal trials for one of those candidates. Young voters who are angry. The Campaign Moment podcast from The Washington Post gives you what matters. I'm Aaron Blake, and I'm covering my 10th election cycle. My colleagues and I have insights that you won't find anywhere else. So follow The Campaign Moment right now, wherever you're listening.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
My sense is that Nettle's death is a major kind of turning point in the trajectory of the group.
My interpretation is that when Nettle's died, that's when that transition occurs. That's when they go from understanding and believing and assuming they're all going to go in bodily form onto the UFO to, and then she dies and her body doesn't go anywhere. That no UFO comes to pick it up. And she, you know, nothing hatches out of her. You know, there's not, you know, it's like, not like Alien, right? So there's no evidence that she in any meaningful way, in any bodily way is going into the next level. So they come to adopt this idea of the soul, and they don't call it the soul. They call it the other things, but it's basically the consciousness. It's an upload process. They use computer terminology. It's an upload the consciousness. But whatever it is that is Bonnie Lou Nettles leaves her human body and returns to outer space. And in her case, it's a return because they understand her as having come from the next level, from outer space to begin with. And from there, then that expands and that becomes the way eventually for all of them. There are ex-members, I should note, who contest me on this, who disagree with this argument, who say, No, this was not the moment of transition. It was much later, and there was not sort of a theological problem at the moment of her death. But I would never dispute those who were there. I understand, you know, they, you know, their particular experiences. But for my interpretation, this was the pivotal moment. And it may have taken a decade until this was publicly discussed and until they decided to embrace suicide, which, as we know, that's how it ends in 1997. But the seeds of that were planted the moment that Bonnie Lou Nettles died.
What year was that?
Bonnie Lou Nettles passed away in June 1985. The rough chronology of the group is that T and Doe, Bonnie Lou Nettles and Marshall Herf Applewhite, meet in 1972. The group itself begins in 74 and 75 and 76 as they're expanding out. That huge moment of transition is when Nettles passes away. And then in 1997 is when the group ends. So that's your rough chronology. You have a, sort of a 10-year period with her and then sort of a 10-year period afterwards, roughly, plus or minus a couple of years.
There was sort of an acceleration of, you know, I don't know if saying that it was sort of performative devotion, but like sort of an intensity of showing how, and I'm particularly talking about castration and, you know, abstinence, like extreme abstinence, I guess. And was that something that, in your view, is a result of Nettles passing away and Applewhite's trying to kind of deal with it and keep the group together? I was trying to get a handle on that.
In that case, I would disagree. All of those practices have their roots very early on. When the group was founded, the basic teaching was you had to move beyond your human existence and you had to abandon your human practices. That included sexuality, included drugs, it included attachments to the people around you. So you had to sort of give up all of those human level addictions and attractions and ways of being because you were trying to give up your human way of being. And again, they used the metaphor. They said a caterpillar can't be a butterfly if it wants to cling to its caterpillar ways. It has to embrace its new life as a butterfly. So they taught very early on, you had to be abstinent, you had to give up drugs and alcohol, you had to give up attachments to loved ones, to your birth family. You couldn't get too attached to your job. All these things go all the way back. They didn't enforce it for the first year because they were very poorly run for the first couple of years. Nettles and Applewhite had all these ideas, but they took no lead in managing the group. So individuals did all sorts of stuff. And then eventually, T and Doe, as they come to call themselves. So Bonnie Lou Nettles, Marshall Herf Applewhite, Bo and Peep, T and Doe, same people. So eventually T and Doe say, no, we have to follow the rules. Understandably, people leave. So they lose a bunch of people. Everyone who stays agrees this is how they want to live their life. They want to basically be a monastic. And that was, again, a term they used. They said, we're basically monastics. So they embrace the monastic lifestyle. And after that, while there were some people who left because they couldn't handle that, the ex-member Sawyer, for example, who was very explicit about this, and he said he couldn't handle the abstinence. This is what wasn't him. So he left for that reason. But there were others who left for other reasons as well. So that wasn't the only reason people left. So that really those extreme practices we see at the end, the castrations and such, go all the way back to the beginning. After T's death, so the question is, was there a sort of a hyper-focus on Applewhite and on sort of dedication to him in the group? We do see the group sort of focus narrow. However, I think given that there was now one leader instead of two, that just follows from, if the group hadn't have done that, they would have dissolved.
Yeah, so it's a group dynamic that's not specific to them.
We have to remember Heaven's Gate, although it eventually died in 1997, the group ended. They were successful. So that means they're going to be marked by certain social characteristics. They did things effectively to keep going. We could imagine a world in which, after Nettles died, Applewhite was incapable of leadership of the group, in which case we wouldn't be having this conversation. They would have dissolved in the 1980s. It's only because Applewhite was able to transform the understanding of salvation, of getting to the next level, and who Nettles was and who he was. Only because he was able to transform that did the group survive 10 more years. There's plenty of new religious movements, UFO-focused and otherwise, that just disappear when the founder dies or loses interest or is arrested or something like that. It's the rare one where the founder, a co-founder, dies and they keep going. Heaven's Gate's really unique in that way. Not unique. I mean, the classic 19th century case is the Mormons, right? I mean, they kept going. But it's unlikely that a new religious movement keeps going after one of the founders dies unexpectedly.
Can you talk a little bit about sort of leading up to the suicide and what the dynamic there was?
The suicides are in 1997. The buildup to the suicides is really 1994. So for the first time in 1994, the suicide is discussed openly as an idea. And there's different stories about how this came up, but the most frequently told story I've been told by ex-members who were present was that this was at a warehouse in California, and that it was 1994, and that Doe, Applewhite, had a group meeting and said, how would you all feel if we left our human vehicles? That was their term for the body. So if we left our human vehicles voluntarily, according to those who were present, there was at least one person who said, I'm not interested in the left. But the rest of them said they were willing. And actually, we do know over the coming 3 years, there were other people who said, I'm not interested in the leave. So Rio D'Angelo, famously, he's the one who finds the bodies. Yeah, he had said that. He said, no, I'm not into this. I don't want to commit suicide. I feel like I have a reason to stay here. There were others as well. In that three-year time period, because this was, again, 3 years before the actual suicides, they vacillated over whether they actually were going to do this or not. They still hoped the UFO was going to pick them up in bodily form. But it was an open possibility over whether that was going to happen, if they would have to leave their human vehicles, as they called them, behind. They also, for a while, were wondering if they would be murdered. So this is around the same time as the Branch Davidian assault. So for those who know their sort of history of American government relations with new religions, so this was the over month-long siege of the Branch Davidians in Waco, which ended with a fire, which it's still extremely contentious whether that fire was set by the Branch Davidians or by the government, whether it was an accident. No one really knows, but they almost all died, the Branch Davidians. So the members of Heaven's Gate thought for a while, well, maybe the government's going to come kill us. You know, they're going to besiege us and we're all going to get shot or burned to death. And that's how our consciousness will be freed from our human bodies to go into the UFO. Of course, that didn't happen. So they had to sort of figure out how are we going to get from point A, Earth, to point B, outer space.
Why the Hale-Bopp comet? How did that sort of relate to the theology, if it did at all?
Members of Heaven's Gate had become quite attuned to a conspiratorial subculture. This actually was coming from the bottom up. I don't actually think Applewhite himself was initially into this, but there were several members of Heaven's Gate who were quite into sort of internet culture or proto-internet culture. Actually, it wasn't even internet. It was dial-up BBSs, and they were part of sort of these chat groups that was into government conspiracies. And that makes sense because they believed in UFOs. So they believed the government was conspiring to hide the presence of UFOs and the presence of extraterrestrials on Earth. And they believed that there were nefarious extraterrestrials, who they called the Luciferians. For those who know sort of pop culture ufology, think sort of the reptiles, think the reptilian hypothesis here. So there's, David Icke and such like that. So there are these reptilian evil space aliens who are conspiring against us, and there's crashed UFOs and things. So there's conspiracies against us. So they get plugged into the conspiratorial world, and they get connected to this claim that the government is hiding the presence of a UFO behind Hale-Bopp Comet, and that all of the publicly released photos have been doctored. And then this breaks into the mainstream with the Art Bell radio show. So Art Bell Coast to Coast and Coast to Coast. Yeah, there's conspiratorial stuff, but that was actually pretty mainstream. Art Bell was not sort of just a nut job. Art Bell was listened to by a lot of people. So Art Bell has this very popular late night AM radio show. And he gets a call in that says, yeah, I've seen it, and I have photographic evidence that there is a UFO following Hale-Bopp Comet. And then a couple of days later, there's another call in from a distance viewer who says, yeah, I was able to project my consciousness, and I was able to see it, and I was able to tour this UFO trailing Hale-Bopp Comet. So there's claims that there's evidence that it's there. And they really bought into this. Now, they hedged their bet a bit. They said, well, even if there's not a UFO there, that doesn't matter. This is the marker we're looking for. The comet itself is the marker. So even if there's not a UFO behind Hale-Bopp, we know the UFO is up there anyways. It may be somewhere else. But the whole world is paying attention. This is our chance to demonstrate to the world the truth of what we've been saying for 20 plus years. And now is our chance, with the world watching, for us to show the truth of our message and to get our word out. You know, they made a website, they had a book, they made videos, they had transcripts, they had basically a press release. they really, in some ways, were trying quite intentionally to get our attention. They'd be, in some ways, thrilled we're still talking about them 25 plus years later. That was their intention.
Some survivors, I think, have talked about how they regret not having been there and taken that leap. What is sort of the afterlife?
There were several members, and sometimes we call them ex-members. It's when people leave these groups, sometimes they rejoin. So there were ex-members who left the group in the 70s or 80s and came back in the 90s. And there were people who left because they couldn't follow the rules, but they still believed the basic principles, the ideas of the group. And this is true across lots of movements, big and small, old and new. I mean, the number of sort of Catholics who sort of, you know, they go to the church, but they sort of like, you know, they still do some Catholic stuff, right? So Heaven's Gate was the same way. So there were people who had left the fold, but they were still basically accepting the premise of the group. And several of them did commit suicide, or in their terminology, they performed their exits and abandoned their vehicles. Wayne Cook, who went by the name of Justody within the group in May 1997, so that was just a few months afterwards, committed an exit. And Chuck Humphrey, who was his Czech partner, so they always worked in groups of two, he attempted to, and his attempt failed. And then later on, he attempted and successfully committed suicide or performed an exit. There were several other members as well, who ex-members. They're all gone now, and there's still a few sort of true believers left who are present on the internet. You can find them around. So Sawyer is probably the best example of sort of a true believer who's left and still talks about his time in the group, and in fact has expanded and tried to sort of explain what the group was about. And he has a pretty active web presence, and you can find him on, last I checked, he's on YouTube, he's on Twitter, he's all over the place.
What important thing haven't I asked you about?
There's so many misconceptions about Heaven's Gate. So the first is sort of this idea that they were brainwashed nut jobs, that there was something wrong with these people. They all left, or not all, nearly all of them left either video testimony or written testimony about why they did what they did, about why they thought suicide made sense. Now, we may disagree, and I disagree. I don't support suicide. And I'm not a believer in Heaven's Gate. So it's not what I would do, and it's not my beliefs. But then again, there's lots of religions out there. They're not what I would do, and not my beliefs, and not my community. And some of them are pretty extreme. And while Heaven's Gate may be more extreme because of the suicide, I don't think we can immediately assume people who do extreme things are crazy or are deluded. They had reasons for what they did. And a lot of that, actually, your listeners can just go to their website. It's still up there. It's maintained by ex-members. You can read some of their exit statements. You can see why it made sense to them. And there was video exits as well, and they're floating around. They were on Vimeo at one point. You can, if you search for Heaven's Gate exit videos, you'll find them. They're floating around. I find these very powerful to listen to because it really humanizes them for me. Again, I don't agree with what they did, and I don't believe as they do, but I want to take them seriously as human beings. Ironically, because they did not want to be human beings. So I always say this, when I talk about that, it humanizes them for me, but I recognize they didn't want to be human. That's the last thing they wanted to be. I, as a human, see them like me. They, in fact, wanted nothing to do with our planet or people like you and me, because they wanted to transcend that. But again, I'm a scholar of religion, so that's okay. I'm okay disagreeing with the people I'm studying. I try to recognize the humanity in them, even if they don't recognize it themselves.
Strange Arrivals is a production of iHeartRadio and Grim and Mild from Aaron Mankey. This episode was hosted by Toby Ball and produced by Rima El-Khayali, Jesse Funk, and Noemi Griffin, with executive producers Alexander Williams, Matt Frederick, and Aaron Mankey, and supervising producer Josh Thane. Learn more about the show at grimandmild.com/strangearrivals. And find more podcasts from iHeartRadio by visiting the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
from BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast, is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18 plus.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.